This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there. It's a pretty amazing planet we live on here, and a man would have to be some kind of fool to think we're all alone in this universe.
There is a hidden world where ancient evil weaves a modern mystery.
What's going on here? Is this some kind of...
magic. The darkest magic.
They call it Little China.
Finally, we shall bring order out of chaos.
It's where big trouble was waiting for Jack Burton.
Who?
Jack Burton. Me.
Jack!
Jack?
Jack!
They told him to go to hell.
You make one move.
And that's just where he's going.
Somebody, I don't care who, tell me what is going on.
How are you gonna spring us?
I have no idea.
There are many mysteries, many unanswerable questions, even in a life as short as yours.
My destiny rests in your capable hands.
Hey, I'll do my best. Take Cracker Jack timing, Wang.
One, two, three. We may be trapped.
Total concentration.
Safety.
Yeah. You ready, Jack?
I was born ready.
Way to go, Jack.
Jack Burton's coming to rescue your summer.
Hey, what more can a guy ask for?
20th Century Fox presents Kurt Russell in John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China.
It's all in the reflexes.
Welcome to No Escape from Kurt Russell on the Siskoid Cinema Feed, the show that explores the filmography of Kurt Russell and his mystique. I'm Siskoid, and a long time ago, blogger Dave Campbell coined the Kurt Russell factor to explain why there are performers who we will gladly see anything they're in, regardless of the movie's synopsis, because Kurt Russell is that guy, or at least one of those guys. We'll test out the theory film by film, and today we're going back to 1986. And Big Trouble in Little China, a box office flop that makes the macho white hero a sidekick? Yeah, but Kurt Russell is in it. So to help me discuss this film is a good friend to the network, and I think a big fan of this film, Dr. Ange. Hi, Ange.
Hey, Siskoid. You leave Jack Burton alone. We are in his debt.
Are we, though? Are we? And you are a fan of this film, right?
A huge fan of this movie, a huge fan of Carpenter, of Kurt Russell, of Kim Cattrall, Victor Wong and James Hong. So this is just like the perfect stew.
Did you see it back in the day?
You know, it's crazy because I've been racking my brain. I am like 98% certain I saw it on the big screen when it came out.
Yeah, because I didn't. This was my kind of movie, but also I lived in a relatively small town and we didn't get everything. But I remember like going, if it was a genre movie, I would go to see it. And this wasn't advertised very well. Is the thing. The studio didn't know how to market it. Did I just miss the boat? I don't know, but I didn't see it in theaters. I might have seen it on television at some point, parts of it or something. My first real memory of watching it as if for the first time is only within the last 10 years, probably. Like, I knew its reputation. Of course, Kurt Russell is in it. So I got it on DVD, like a bit sight unseen, like I bought a lot of DVDs in those days the same way. And that's how I watched it, as if for the first time, let's say. And it was a hoot. You know?
Wow.
Oh, yeah, really. I don't know. I'm not even sure because at some point I watched so many movies, it's all become a blur as to what, when, what, unless it was when I was a kid. And I would have a very definite memory if I'd seen this in the theaters at the time. What kind of memory? That's up in the air. So if you haven't seen Big Trouble in Little China, we're about to spoil the heck out of it, obviously. But broadly, and this is right out of, you know, the movie's synopsis copy. When trucker Jack Burton agrees to take his friend Wang Chi to pick up his fiancée at the airport, he never expected to get involved in a supernatural battle between good and evil. Wang's fiancée has emerald green eyes, which makes her a perfect target for immortal sorcerer Lo Pan and his three invincible cronies. Lo Pan must marry a girl with green eyes so he can regain his physical form. That's the premise. And as I take it, the studio thought it was getting an Indiana Jones type movie. This is not that.
Yeah, you know, I feel like the first thing that you said where it wasn't, like they didn't know how to market it, is perfect if you ever watched the trailer. The trailer is like the blandest trailer that makes Kurt Russell look like he's a little bit unstoppable, but almost boring, which is the last thing I would say about this movie, which, yes, you said those sentences, and yes, all of those things are true, but I feel like this whole thing is like a fever dream fueled by, you know, caffeine and psychedelics.
It's a parody of those kinds of movies. You know, so I think the trailer, and people have just heard the trailer. I played it as the opening music to this episode. There's two things when you market a movie, which can be tough. How much surprise you want to keep, right?
Yeah.
And you're going to lure people to an action movie, which has these Eastern mysticism vibes to it. Okay. But do you reveal that it's really a send-up of that? That it's a comedy, a parody of the sort of macho action movies of the day? You know, so if a person goes because he thinks it's going to be like this macho action movie, they're going to be disappointed. And I know I've read some old reviews of this where people didn't understand that the person they thought was the hero of the piece, played by Kurt Russell, wasn't really. You know,
yeah.
You know, so they didn't get it because they were expecting this other thing, which I think that the bland trailer kind of sells you on. But at the same time, if I'm the audience for a parody of action movies, which I totally am, then, you know, you're not drawing me to the theater by not telling me that. But also, when I finally do see it, it's a knee slapper. I'm really having a good time with it because that's not necessarily what I was expecting. If you saw it back in the day, was it a surprise? And was it a good surprise? I mean, obviously, you can fall in love with something later, but did you immediately get it?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing is, to hop onto your discussion, if all you did in the trailer was show the silly parts of Jack Burton, like not being the hero and failing, you might go in thinking it really is like a Three Stooges movie. It's not that either, right? There's some pretty significant action in this. It is a crazy mystic plot in the whole thing. So it really is sort of a whole bunch of different things. But I agree, it is certainly not the macho movie of the 1980s. I think that for me, I had probably seen The Thing a couple of years before this movie came out to the big screen on like a VHS tape or on HBO, something like that. Completely fell in love with that. Kind of then went on to say, like, what else has this guy John Carpenter done? And then saw this. And there is enough comedy, comic book action, weird mysticism, Dungeons and Dragons and video game references in this that it was like, for I was 16 at the time, this was the best thing that ever could have been put on this earth. And I'm just going to again say, and it'll probably be something I mentioned throughout this, Kim Cattrall at this stage of her career was probably, if there was a poster, it was on my wall. She could probably do no wrong, right? Turk 182, Mannequin, Big Trouble in Little China. So it really was like the best of all worlds. I think I loved it right away. And this was one of those ones that I had on a VHS tape that joined me in college that I watch with my buddies all the time.
Because Kim Cattrall at this point, from what I've read, was really more into like theater. And she was subsidizing her theater work with these movie parts. And then, of course, well, we know that she went on to do bigger and broader things. You know, and we will talk about her, obviously. But let's talk a little bit about Kurt Russell, was our main topic, really. And how much of his screen persona, this is his fourth movie already with Carpenter at this point, out of the five. And I think Carpenter chose him in part because he'll do anything. And I think you need someone without, like, they're talking about doing a, I don't know if it's a reboot or a sequel or just part of the Big Trouble universe, but they're talking about doing one with Dwayne Johnson, The Rock. And if there's someone who is, I mean, he can do comedy and he can laugh at himself, but also A lot of ego on set. A lot of, I can't be shown in certain situations. And that's not Kurt Russell.
Yes. And it's certainly not Jack Burton. So that sounds like a terrible idea to me.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't be Jack Burton. Yeah. And maybe Jack Burton would show up, you know, an older Jack Burton. I don't know. This was discussed at some point. I have no idea if it's still on the boards or what. But I agree with you. It's like the reason this works is that Kurt Russell is so game for anything and to look foolish. And he gets it. You know, he gets that he's the joke. He's the punching bag in this thing.
Yeah. And you're coming off of Snake Plissken in Escape from New York and, you know, MacReady in The Thing, who are kind of like the machoist of macho people are for MacReady, at least like, you know, a badass. And so if you're like, oh, it's a John Carpenter movie with Kurt Russell, it's probably going to be one of these macho badass things. And then he does the exact opposite. And it's true that he's very endearing and lovable in this movie. And you kind of laugh when these things happen. You never feel like, oh, my gosh, he's being belittled, or you don't feel sad for him in any way. He's like a stranger in a strange land to me in this movie, and a little bit overwhelmed by all the stuff that's happening.
I think there's a supercut on YouTube of just Jack Burton asking what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
Because he's never in control of what's happening. He doesn't understand the narrative, the plot, the stakes at any point, really. He's just following along. He falls into this. It doesn't take you too much time to realize that Dennis Dunn in this, Wang, is not the sidekick, even though he has the casting of the sidekick. He's the actual hero. He's the one who can take care of himself. He does the martial arts. He's, you know, he's flying through the air. I would say on wires, but they mostly use trampolines to do those effects. Like really old school kung fu effects. He understands the plot. He knows the lore. You know, he's in control. And it's his girlfriend who is captured by Lo Pan. So really, it's his story. And then we are tricked into believing, because we've got Kurt Russell there, because of you're completely correct. The Carpenter plus Kurt Russell gives you an expectation and then confounds that expectation. Like in reality, he's the sidekick. He's the drive. He drives into town. He's supposed to be like the Lone Ranger or something. No, like his friendship with Wang grows through the movie. But at the beginning, it's like, I don't trust you to give me the money that I won gambling. So it's not even like a close friendship. It's not even, he's there for the cash.
Yeah.
He's an anti-hero, but also a foolish one. Not an anti-hero like somebody who's on the edge, a Punisher. No, he's the anti-hero who doesn't really want to be in this story, but he's kind of trapped in it.
Yeah, and he could be a hero because he's certainly brave enough, right? There is not one moment where he's not like, I am joining you to try to do this thing, which could be extremely dangerous to me, right? He could have left at any time, but you're exactly right. He can't get out of his own way. And the Dennis Dunn thing is crazy, because how many scenes are there where it's like, okay, the two of us are about to do something dramatic, and then Jack either like throws his knife away and has to go get it, or is pinned underneath the weight of somebody heavy. And in the meantime, Dennis Dunn has like eliminated 8 people with kung fu, or is sword fighting a demigod, you know? So it's really wild to see that. And then you can just see that he wants so much to be the hero. Even the way he talks, there's a bravado in his, you know, the checks in the mail kind of a, you know, sometimes Jack Burton says, what the hell, right? So there are these trappings of him being this thing, but he just kind of can't get to the uber fantastic Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis kind of a status in actions.
No, like his greatest hits, like he shoots in the air, you know, like just to get attention and intimidate, but he gets, the ceiling falls on his head and he gets knocked out for a bit. Kim Cattrall saves him from the monster towards the end there. I love that moment where she kisses him, and then when he comes out of that elevator, he's completely smeared with lipstick. Like for the whole scene, it's ridiculous. From what I've heard from Carpenter and Russell on, you know, if you listen to the DVD commentary, all they, like they're drinking beer and laughing their asses off throughout. So they have a great rapport, those two. But one of the things is that this was not planned. This was not in the script. They kissed. Of course, there was smearing because like makeup is often very fresh and to be luscious. And so it smeared and they just, this is hilarious, let's keep going with this. And Kurt Russell's, being game as he is, said, sure. Where another action star might not have found this as funny or as appropriate, you know, maybe shameful to his persona. But yeah, so like that's a great moment as well, you know? So it's always full of these, and we're used to, if you look at the legacy of this thing in a way, we have a lot of these heroes now. If you know, something like Guardians of the Galaxy is absolutely built like Big Trouble in Little China in terms of deflating the heroism of its characters. Like show them being, you know, we're big heroes, and then like stumbling. Something stupid happens to deflate the situation. I feel like this was sort of avant-garde in terms of what we think of as action comedies today.
He's, Kurt Russell, that is, obviously doesn't have the big enough ego that he can't go along with all of this, which I think if you came out with this today in our very fractured civilization today, people might be like, oh, another example of the man being a loser and the woman has to save him, or the diverse sidekick has to save him. So I don't know if you could exactly make this today, just given, like, I can only imagine the rants that would be on social media. But at the time, I think you're right. This is completely refreshing and unheard of. And probably one of the reasons why I think it works so well is that he's so quotable, right? I quote Jack Burton a lot in my life, but it's always in the context of him shooting the ceiling and getting knocked out, or, you know, having a tiny red rubber ball blown into his abdomen and being knocked over.
I mean, even little moments like at the end when they're racing out, you know, he rams his truck through the door, and it's a race out of hell, essentially, because that's where the story takes place, in the Chinese hells underneath Chinatown. And then it's like immediately Kim Cattrall says, red light. That's a yes to stop.
Yeah.
Normally, like, that's where you play the music and it's, you know, he's off. It's not exactly a chase, but it might have been a chase. No. Yeah, I've got to stop for this. And there's humanity in this character, because there's a moment where he's about to shoot someone. He's got a newsie, of course. It's like the 80s trope. He shoots and it somebody has to tell him, you know, safety's on. Oh, so then he has to, okay, fidget with it. And then he shoots the guy. He's almost surprised by the gunfire. And then, you know, the other guy asks him, is it the first time you ever popped someone? No, you know, like he denies it, but it's obvious that it is.
It's obvious that it is. Yeah.
You know, so it's moments like that. And I feel like there's some humanity there, but I think we have to address the fact that he's Kurt Russell. That is really, I think there's a pretty bold choice to do a John Wayne impression throughout. Because that's what it is, right?
It's the most over-the-top, I think, sort of like bravado, right? And all of these catchphrases, right? Like, you know, may the wings of liberty never lose a feather, right? Like all that sort of stuff. All in the context of then, like you said before, of being completely lost. Like, what will come out no more, right? You know, he's sort of lost. But it's crazy that he acts or says the words of the big, tough guy. But his actions don't match them.
And he's got the accent and everything. You know, it's like there is that drawl right out of John Wayne. And I've also heard that as Snake Plissken, he was doing Clint Eastwood. So I can't wait to revisit that film for the show and like listen to the, because I remember it, but also I wasn't necessarily clued in. Like this, I feel, with Jack Burton, it's so obvious that he's, you know, he's doing the Duke. But yeah. I didn't really notice that it was Clint Eastwood in that other film, or those two other films. So when I revisit these for the show, I've been listening to that. It's interesting that he's the macho action star, and also kind of based on the Western. Originally, this was supposed to be a Western. Did you know?
Oh, no.
The original script takes place in the Old West. It's San Francisco, but it's in the 1880s or something like that. So it's supposed to be, the truck is supposed to be a horse. The horse gets stolen by the bad guys, who I imagine would have been, what, coolies or something? You know, like that trope from the, like, Victorian or Western tropes of what a Chinese menace of that time would have been, I guess. It's the same movie. It was the same story, but taking place in the past. The studio or Carpenter or whoever, the powers that be, didn't want to make this a period piece. So then they just redressed it, put it in modern times. And I don't know if Kurt Russell read that original script or was told about that original premise or what, because it was rewritten, obviously had to be rewritten probably before he ever saw it. But that he takes on the persona of a Western star, to me, is extremely funny in the context of knowing the history. But at the same time, like, he's that American action star. And then you've got like all the Chinese characters, the Chinese American characters are out of Shaw Brothers, you know, they're out of kung fu movies. So that's like that idea of the superhero. And then I want your take on this. What do you think Kim Cattrall is doing. Because that sounds unkind, but she has like a very deliberate delivery in this. It's not a naturalistic way of speaking. Her name is Gracie Law, and she's a lawyer. So it feels like she's also supposed to be a type, some sort of character from a certain medium.
It's funny. She obviously has feelings for Jack by the end of this, but she denies them all. She tries to be like a little bit upper crust and sort of like, you know, I guess social justice warrior, for the lack of better words, for back in 1986, sort of trying to protect the rights of people. I think she's trying to play the like, I'm the high class girl and you're the lower class hardworking guy that I should never be attracted to. I wonder if it's a little bit of a Dave and Maddie from Moonlighting kind of a thing, but maybe that's too much.
Possibly. I always felt like she was like right out of a comic book. She was Lois Lane, and she was speaking the way that a character would be written on a page, but not in the way that a person speaks normally. It's not always there, but there's an archness to it that seems an unnatural, a very stylized way of speaking. And they're all speaking in stylized ways, you know, in a way, because let's talk like all the lore and all of that. So like the Chinese characters have that aspect to it. Jack Burton speaks like he's in a Western. She speaks like she's in a, I don't know, a pulp story. Like,
yeah,
there's something going on there that I think is on purpose, is what I mean. So I think she's a very interesting character. And I love that ending between them, because she's not really the love interest. She's the love interest, but not, you know, they do share a kiss there. But at the end, when he's just leaving, all right, well, I got to go. The characters there say, aren't you even going to kiss her goodbye? And he just says no.
Right.
He just says no. That would be the movie thing. The star of this film would be getting that kiss. I am not the star of this film. Wang is. I'm not doing the action movie thing that you want me to be doing. Like, he's an anti-hero to the end. Just because we just shared an adventure doesn't mean I'm suddenly, you know, like,
yeah,
I'm suddenly like sexually active with her or anything, which is a common action trope. So they're even deflating that aspect, which is going much further than a Guardians of the Galaxy, for example.
Yeah. And I like, he's very self-aware in that moment, right? He says, look, eventually everybody kind of gets sick of me, right? You know, so we shouldn't get together. So I think he has a little bit of self-reflection there. But now that you say it, that's exactly right, right? This is at the end of Die Hard. His estranged wife gives him a huge kiss as money is falling all over them, right? That's the big action hero moment. And here he just says no, right? And when I just watched it again last night, I kind of forgot how blunt the no was. And part of me, even though I've seen this a billion times, was like, oh, maybe I remember them kissing. Does he go back in and get a kiss? And the answer is no, right? And that may just be my expectations as a moviegoer, anticipating that the kiss is going to happen, and it just never does.
So I can imagine why the studio didn't know how to market this. It did flop at the box office, which is never something that I care about, because as this movie shows, this has picked up a cult following at the very least, but it is now a beloved film. Too many people failed to see it at the time, right? It didn't generate revenue at the time, so who cares? Probably seen me online fighting with people who think box office is important. But this, I mean, movies like this show it's not important, because we're now almost 40 years later and it is a beloved film. And when people say, well, what are like the best Carpenter films? What are the best Kurt Russell films? This movie is in those lists. So who cares? It's moments like this where you can also imagine the normal people, the normies, the mundanes sitting at a movie theater expecting a certain thing, those same expectations you're describing, and seeing it at the time especially. Because I think today, yes, it could be made. It just wouldn't have that same impact. I think today, this is a movie that they would make today, and it would be on purpose to have. You're saying that's like a political hot potato, but it's not really. A lot of Hollywood does this.
Yeah.
Especially with female characters replacing what traditionally would have been male characters, and it freshens up old formulas. Because we've seen that male white action hero thing, it doesn't even have to be action, hundreds of times.
Yeah.
So just switching that out gives it a new context, and I think there's a lot of movie making that plays with that, and I think to great effect.
Yeah.
But it's not the same as you're totally expecting a thing and you are not getting that thing. So I can imagine audiences even like that kiss at the end. Like, I've had girlfriends who I watch movies with, and they just had like the impulse to ship everybody in the movie. You know, that was just like the expected thing in the sorts of movies that they watched. And when, you know, when something does not turn out to be a rom-com and the people don't get the kiss at the end, it was a disappointment, you know? So I remember those conversations. And it's usually with people who watch, you know, fewer movies than I do per capita.
Well, you know, I watch a ton of movies just like you do. And I'll say, you know, you're right that this could be made again today, but somehow I think Carpenter, as bold and as crazy as this is, kind of walks a little bit like down the middle of the road. Like I can see somebody doing this and just going too extreme and making it too foolish, right? Because I think that the Chinese characters are treating this very, very seriously. And that's part of the fun of Kurt Russell reacting to them, is that they're saying all of these things as if he should understand what they mean, right? You know, like, China is here, Mr. Burton. I don't know what that means, right? You know, that's the black blood of the earth. I don't know what that means. But to get back to the normie side of things, I literally watched this again, I said last night, with my girlfriend. She's a little bit of a normie. And I think for people like us who have just been, like, you know, steeped in comic books, right? Oh, it makes sense. He's cursed by a demon to be of no flesh, but then he has to appease the emperor by killing the person that he marries, and he wants to become flesh, and he has these three storms that do it. There's like a lot of stuff that you just have to like roll with, which I think as comic book readers we are. 30 minutes in, she looked at me and she said, I literally have no idea what's going on in this movie, you know, because...
Just like Jack.
Yeah, because I think part of the plot is like, she's like, I don't quite understand, like they kidnapped that girl and then they brought her to like a brothel, but then those guys kidnapped her, and then who is this guy? And I think when you're used to that sort of storytelling, you can just sort of accept it all. When it was over, she was like, yeah, I can tell you really liked that movie. But I don't think that she necessarily got as much out of it as I did.
I think that's a normal expectation that people have going into a film, is that I will understand the story. You know, like our own Hot Squad, you know, at Ohami or not, Amelie is famous for never understanding what a MacGuffin, what the MacGuffin is supposed to be, why the MacGuffin is important, what the MacGuffin does in any movie that she's watched. She watches a lot of those action movies and she's just like, she's frustrated. She's trying to understand what the MacGuffin does. And we always say, Amelie, doesn't matter what the MacGuffin does. The MacGuffin is just the thing that people run after, and the MacGuffin does what the MacGuffin has to do at that point in the movie, according to the script. It's not important. You know, like the MacGuffin is the least important thing in this, even though everybody in the movie thinks it is important. And this is sort of like this, like same thing for me. I was watching it and it's like, there's so much lore. And I think we're supposed to be overwhelmed by it.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be Jack Burton.
Yeah.
We're supposed to go, what the hell's going on? I don't understand any of this. And it's like people are running circles around him. And they understand the story. Just like I said, it's like, what if an American hero and, you know, what if Lois Lane and John Wayne somehow teamed up and you know, they crashed a party in Chinatown where already in progress, there is a Shaw Brothers mystical kung fu movie going on. They're not part of this setup.
Yeah.
They are not normally in this. It is not their world. It is not their tropes. They're just move along with that story and help out when they can. I mean... You know, Jack still gets that final knife in Lopan's head, but it's almost accidental. It's reflexes, of course. And it, like, they're trapped in this story. Like, imagine those two characters, but they're in a space opera. They're in, you know, whatever, a horror film, which this kind of touches on. But they're not made for it. They have a completely different set of skills. And if this were an American action film or American comic book, it would be great. But no, they're in a kung fu flick. Even worse, I think they're in the memory of a kung fu flick. Because I've watched hundreds of kung fu films. It's one of my things. On this viewing, I was trying to... What can I spot in terms of actual references? And I really can't.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really any reference to any actual... It's the mystical stuff with magic and wizards that you'd get in something like The Bride with White Hair or the Bastard Swordsman, Return of the Bastard Swordsman, that's like this really weird stuff in it that kind of looks like what Lopan is up to. You know, stuff like that, maybe like Hopping Vampires, Mr. Vampire, that kind of stuff. Chinese Ghost Story, maybe. It's kind of that stuff, but... It goes back, there's a tradition of that like the most famous earlier ones is Come Drink With Me in 1968, which was one of the important inspirations for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. But even that had a precursor to that where they were basically doing all the lightning effects by just scratching up the film physically. They're like old black and whites with these lightning blasts, and that was just like scratches on the film because you couldn't do like video effects, which is what this is. There is a part of the Kung Fu film where there is magic, where the wuxia goes over the top and there are wizards. And these are the kinds of effects or elements that we see in this. But also, it's not like any specific one. It's really like Carpenter. I mean, maybe the writers had something in mind, but whatever Carpenter's doing, he has a sort of memory of Kung Fu flicks and what they look like and what they feel like, but he's not like doing references. He's creating it out of whole cloth. You know, like this story is entirely original within the genre that it's half emulating, half parodying.
You know, the thing that caught my attention last night was the further the movie goes, the crazier it gets for Jack to be involved, right? So it starts out with a kidnapping at an airport, and then it's like going to the brothel to try to rescue her. And then before that is even, there's the kung fu fight in the alley, then going to a brothel to try to rescue somebody, then going to a factory where there's some weird stuff going on, then going underground where there's even weirder stuff going on, to the fight in the temple. So it's like, he just keeps going farther and farther away from normal world. And so there is this sort of, you start out, you know, with the gunfight and the alley fight, and you end with, you know, magical rockets and astral projection video game characters fighting each other. But it is all different aspects of kung fu movies. As you say, you clearly know way more about kung fu movies than me, but I certainly watched plenty of them on Saturday afternoons on my local television to sort of get those tropes.
I mean, there are some elements, like maybe like the Three Storms, who each have their weapon. You know, that's like the very classic kung fu thing where everybody has their specialized weapon. And a lot of those weapons, you wonder, are they real weapons? And yeah, they actually usually are. I don't know about the... the sort of propellers in the hand.
Yeah.
But I think I've seen them in a kung fu movie, maybe. So they're not necessarily like one of the 12 weapons of Shaolin, but they may still be a thing. But some people have said, oh, these are like the three assassins in one of the Lone Wolf and Cub films, uh-huh. Baby Cart Goes to Hell, which would make sense with this the hellish element here. I don't really know that just happens to look alike and not necessarily be the same. Anyway, I don't know. But also you've got like, you know, that beholder head floating around, uh-huh. The Guardian, which is a really well-made animatronic creature. It almost has to be CG in some, like it's too solid to be CG, but also it's got too great a range of expressions, but it is an animatronic creature.
That's crazy because it does. It licks its own eyes at one point. It has like a smug half smile at one point when Lopan is talking through it. Crazy puppet work. And for me, that was again like, you know, I was like, oh my God, there's like a D&D reference in here, right? That's clearly like a beholder from Dungeons & Dragons, which just sort of added more love for young me.
And especially once they go underground. And now we can talk about a dungeon.
Yeah.
You know, it really is a dungeon with levels. Especially when you get out of it, you realize how many levels this was, how deep this went. I mean, it goes right to the blood of the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a dungeon, so it can have these monsters. There's another monster as well, sort of, I don't know, Asian Yeti creature. I don't know, an animal man.
Yeah.
It's got everything in it. So we might as well call it Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah.
at that point. The moment where it really goes wild is when they enter, what did they call it? Like the hell of upside down sinners.
Yes. Yeah.
And they have to go through this place where it's just like a room filled with water and corpses. And then from there, suddenly now they're in the underground and Lopan's world. It's got a lot of what I think are like Shaw Brothers type sets. You know, there's a lot of like Chinese sets. When they translated this to the modern era, these things still look like they're ancient 19th century rooms. But by the time you get to that final, the temple where they are having that wedding, that double wedding, because Lopan's going to have his cake and eat it too, right? He's found two green-eyed girls because Kim Cattrall also has green eyes in this. Let's say both actresses have green lenses.
Yeah.
And he's going to marry two of them so then he can marry one to become flesh. He's a ghost at this point. He's like a wizard slash ghost spirit. And he wants to achieve power. He needs to be in the physical world and as a flesh being, which also makes him vulnerable. So he can marry one and keep her. And then the other one he can kill to appease the spirit of the emperor who he's cursed. And I guess part of that curse is that he has to appease the emperor who wants the bride to be dead. So he can kill one bride and keep the other. So, but in that temple is like neon lit.
Yeah.
It's like a discotheque in there. And then all the flying around and all the, you know, it's like all the kung fu tricks. Old school, to me, that's great stuff. You know, that whole part is, even though he's not necessarily relating this to specific kung fu films, and he may, because there's so many, seeing 100 or 200 or 300 or whatever I have, there's still tons that I haven't seen. Regardless of that, the movie making is from that branch of cinema.
All of the different weapons, like you talk about, that early fight, like it's a mix of machine guns and 2x4s. It's like anything that can become a weapon will become a weapon as these guys sort of duke it out. And then the end is much more magical, obviously, with all of the jumping and sword fighting in the midair while they're flying around is just great.
It goes even to like the very top of the film when we finally see the title. There's a Chinese title in there as well, you know, like all those kung fu films. There's like you see the English title and there's a title you can't read because we can't read Chinese. And this one, I actually found the translation for it. The Chinese title of Big Trouble in Little China is Evil Spirits Make a Big Scene in Little Spiritual State. If you've ever seen a kung fu film, like a Shaw Brothers, like a 70s, early 80s kung fu film, then you're going to have a sense of deja vu and understand that it's part of that canon, but also like it knows it's joking about this. So it's a parody of those films. It's a parody of American action films, especially. I wonder how this would have played with John Carpenter's original choice for Wang Chi, because he originally wanted Jackie Chan for this.
Oh.
Jackie was just coming off the success of Police Story. I think it would have been the wrong choice. Like, he couldn't get it. Jack passed on it, was too busy with other things. Indeed, in 1986, I think there's like 4 or 5 Jackie Chan films that come out in Hong Kong. So it's insane. So Dennis Dunn is cast instead. I think it works better with an unknown.
Yeah, somebody who doesn't have like the physical characteristics of Jackie Chan, right? Dennis Dunn is a pretty slim guy. So you're not expecting all of the insane stuff that he's able to do with, you know, background kicks and just throwing people around the way that he does. But you're right. If it was a big name, you would anticipate him having a big role in this movie. And so instead, what happens with Wang comes off as very much a surprise as the movie rolls out.
Right. It would have been Shanghai Nights or something.
Yeah.
Isn't that like the Western one? I haven't seen it. Sorry.
Yeah. Whatever the one with Owen Wilson, right? Is it Owen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if it were a Western, like the original vision of this, that would have been Shanghai Nights. I'm really happy it's not. I love Jackie Chan, love Jackie Chan movies, but he would just have taken over. It would not have been a surprise that he would have at least a co-starring impact on the film where he's the hero and Jack Burton's only the sidekick. Yeah. I mean, it's Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
Even if he wasn't that well-known in 86, especially in retrospect, we've just gone, yeah, it's a Jackie Chan movie. We wouldn't have thought of it as a Kurt Russell movie where somehow, despite appearances, despite attitude, and he's got that attitude all throughout, you know, like it doesn't matter to him. Like Jack Burton says, it's like, who's Jack Burton? And he's like frustrated.
Yeah.
He's not better known. You're just a trucker, dude. You know, like he's got his own radio show and his CB basically like talking to other trucks. Like he's got that shtick going. So he must be, I don't know, in his community, he may be known, but it really feels like he stepped into something that's way beyond himself. But he doesn't, at the end, he still has that full confidence. I don't think he's necessarily changed by this, you know?
No.
Like he's not, at the end, he doesn't think, oh no, I'm not the hero. He's just like, I don't know. I don't think he's changed at all.
I'm right there with you. I think he's the same. I think that he has just let this wash over him. And he probably thinks he's a hero in the story. Like you say, at the end, he does get the kill shot. And he's certainly an important part of the story, but his bravado doesn't match. Again, I keep saying it, right? He doesn't quite meet the usual expectations of what we would think would be the primary hero.
Do you think this would have worked with someone other than Kurt Russell?
I think it has to be an actor who's very, very likable and who somehow can play it again down the road where he's very earnest and serious in all of the things that he says, even if he isn't able to pull it off. So I'm trying to think of back then, right? Like Bruce Willis was on the cusp of Die Hard and was in the middle of Moonlighting, and I think he would just be too snarky about the whole thing and it wouldn't work. So I really think Kurt Russell is perfect for this role.
One of the things that we've mentioned in past discussions is that he's a little self-effacing.
Yeah.
He doesn't believe his own cred as the hero of whatever narrative. Like it was true of Tombstone, where he was totally macho, totally, you know, but at the same time, when he's confronted by the Dana Delaney character, and she's very upfront, he's like, he's speechless and he doesn't know what to say. And so there's a humility there that I think comes from the actor himself and in the things that he's put up with, like in this particular movie. So let's ask, when all is said and done, and I'm using Gillis and Doran's formula from Podcast de la Vista, baby. Is Big Trouble in Little China a good movie?
For me, the answer is yes. I was thoroughly tickled seeing it last night for the billionth time. It all just, it's just, again, I keep saying it's like the perfect mix of action and comedy and nerdiness and all of that sort of stuff. And I think that his character is just a great one on screen for all of the reasons that we've talked about. That mix of who he thinks he is and what he actually is doing.
I mean, the same year we got The Golden Child, which is also an action comedy, Eddie Murphy in this case, with this Chinese mysticism, something Chinatown, monsters, magic, came out a few months later. It was probably going to come out before, and it's like they rushed Big Trouble in Little China to theaters to beat this competitor's, I don't know the studios, but the competitor's Golden Child. And The Golden Child is really weird, man. Obviously, Big Trouble in Little China is strange, but it sells the strangeness. And even though Eddie Murphy is kind of playing the character who thinks this is weird, just like Jack Burton in this thinks this is weird, you know, to him, I think like pushing it towards more comedy because it is Eddie Murphy, I think it just feels like it's unhinged, like there's two parts to it. Like the cop comedy elements and the Chinese mysticism elements don't really mesh together, and you're constantly, and perhaps because Eddie Murphy's a little too wise, a little too snarky, a little too knowing that this is a comedy. Whereas in this, Jack Burton has no clue that he's in a comedy.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's how you sell it. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say, I've already said I quote Big Trouble in Little China a lot. I only have one quote from Golden Child. So it already wins on the how many times Ange quotes.
Is it I have the knife?
No, it's only a man whose ass is narrow could like walk across the bridge, whatever he's trying to do with a glass of water. But again, Murphy is much more right. It's Charlotte Lewis, right, plays the love interest. And there's much more of a classic movie feel between hero and woman in that movie, as far as I recall, in comparison to this.
It doesn't go far enough in some ways. And it just feels like it's two movies bashed together. Whereas with Jack Burton, it's a character from another movie inside a full movie. There's no friction between two parts of a movie.
This is clearly a cult classic. The Golden Child is not a cult classic. The Golden Child is probably lost to memory. So, you know, so if we're just comparing those two, this is far and away the superior movie.
And so is Big Trouble in Little China a good Kurt Russell movie? Does it make the best use of him as a screen actor?
I'm going to say, obviously, the answer is yes, right? He's very, very charming in this movie for all of the things that we've talked about. I really just like the fact that there isn't one problem that his friend is getting into that he's not right. I'm right there with you, right? You know, we're going to go, you know, try to crash into this evil warlord's thing. All right, you know, that's what we have to do. We have to do what's right. And I think that just makes him very endearing. And then all of the sort of his inability to be a truly active part of this whole thing is another great wrinkle. And then he's got great lines, right? Like, what's in the bag? Oh, a seven demon bag, right? Or the whole, I would rather climb up 3 stories of a greased elevator cable. At least I know it's real and I can hold it, right? Because everything is crazy around him. And so I think he's almost like a point of view character, because obviously that's not a world I'm used to either. So I think he's great. And I do think that coming off of Pliskin and MacReady, it's like just like a trifecta. You know, I mean, that's you can't beat that.
I completely agree. I think the fact that he's sort of an everyman, so that makes him the point of view character. And like, he's you if you were a little more physical. I don't think we subscribe to we're not the meatheads of our groups.
Yeah.
He's sort of the meathead of his group. And he's like, he's a physical presence, obviously. Like Jack Burton, he's sort of there to push doors open, sort of thing, you know? He's our access into this world that we don't quite understand, and that makes him relatable. But I think only someone like Kurt Russell can sell us the refuse to kiss the girl at the end, not take the spoils of the adventure, which he doesn't really deserve and somehow knows he doesn't deserve, and just get back on the horse, almost literally, but in this case, the truck, the Pork Chop Express. You know, even that's silly.
Yeah.
I think there's something there that works. Like, he's an action star, but also relatable in the same way that you could say about John McClane up to a point, but more so.
Yeah.
So yes, this is one of the seminal Kurt Russell movies. And I wanted to do it early. Thanks for indulging in some Russell mania with me today, Ange.
I'll just say thanks for inviting me. This is clearly one of my like all-time favorites. So just a joy to talk about.
I'll let you go back into the theater. We'll play a trailer. And I'll be back for your feedback on our previous episode in which Sean Myers and I discussed the computer war tennis shoes.
Which is the hottest Marvel character?
Iron Man.
Ant-Man. I can't decide between Professor X and Magneto, so both.
Loki.
Is Wolverine Marvel?
What about White Tiger?
What about White Tiger?
Doc Samson.
Who's
Star Fox.
That's a video game.
The girls go on a journey to determine every Marvel character's hotness in Ohotmu or Not, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe podcast you didn't know you wanted. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
And now your comments on our previous episode, in which Sean Myers and I discussed the computer war 10 issues. First, Brian Schufo says, these Kurt Russell Disney movies absolutely terrified me as a kid, especially the Dexter Riley ones. So much so that I haven't watched them again since seeing them as a kid. Stretchy arms from lifting weights, disappearing heads and fingers, brains slowing down, total nightmare fuel. Then we have Dr. Ange, who was just my guest on this particular episode. He says, I saw these films mostly on Wonderful World of Disney, only when I could. We would often visit my grandparents on Sunday nights when Disney aired, and it ran against the Lawrence Welk show. Grandparents' house, grandparents' shows. Oof, Ange, I watched a lot of Lawrence Welk as a kid, too. Anyway, he goes on. Luckily, the adults would occasionally abandon the TV room and let the kids watch. Definitely love these movies, but for some reason, Strongest Man sticks in my head the most, maybe because of the comic bookiness of the powers. Yes, those stretchy arms freaked me out, but also Phil Silvers swinging from the chandeliers as well, and also the fact that it appeared the cereal was Fruit Loops, a cereal we were never allowed to eat as a kid, and therefore, mysterious and sort of forbidden, probably helps makes it stick. I remember this one too, just nowhere near as much. And Chris Franklin says, fun show, guys. The two movies Disney Plus has chosen to include were some of the first things I watched when the streamer debuted. I have fond memories of watching these on Wonderful World and the early days of the Disney Channel, back when they just showed old Disney movies and series. Now, if they would only release Now You See 'Em, Now You Don't on there. Probably the most influential Russell-Disney collaboration for me was when he narrated a trip he and the Osmonds and a few other celebrities took to the recently opened Haunted Mansion in Disneyland. This was from 1969 as well, and before my time, but it reran on Wonderful World and the Disney Channel too. It began my lifelong obsession with my favorite theme park ride. That's funny you should reference that, Chris. I was at a friend's house recently, and he was throwing up various YouTube videos on the TV. And that's one he chose out of the blue, urging me, in fact, to do an episode about it. And I'm not sure it counts. We never know. Siskoid Cinema's No Escape from Kurt Russell is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. So if you're listening to this and have your own opinions about what we've discussed, please feel free to head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com to leave a comment. I'll read them on our next episode. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcasts. We're done here, so cut it, print it.